Genevieve Abdo is our guest. We're with her in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We cannot have this conversation go further without talking about women in the society. Again, you opened up so many different interesting ideas.
The single most striking, I think, aside from the notion that these moderate Islamists are the best hope for Egypt, that was striking. But the role of women in this, both in theory, but also in their as part of the movement, is surprising.
I want to start with the distinction you make between how the Islamists say that women are viewed in the West and how the Islamists say they're viewed in the East. Talk about power and passivity and open up a whole new world here when thinking about Islamic feminists. It's even hard to say that.
The way to talk about an Islamic feminist is to describe a woman who wears a veil, who is university educated, who wants to be a professional, to have a job such as being a lawyer, doctor, to want to have the same earning power as men, to make the same salary, a woman who wants to be involved in politics, if that's her choice, but a woman who wears a veil
by choice,
and who wants to be the center of family life, who wants to have complete control and much more influence on raising her children than her husband.
Control of the children?
Well, and how the children are raised and how the family is run. A woman who wants to prepare meals every day for her family. This is an Islamic feminist, which is a tall order and probably includes many more responsibilities than we in the West would possibly dream of achieving in any sort of successful way.
Well, in the West, we look to shed some of things, and they're trying to embrace them.
Yes, and I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about how a woman can be an Islamic feminist. But the women that I met in Egypt really believe that if they wear a veil, that doesn't mean that they suddenly become a second-class citizen. That simply is an expression of the value they place on religion. It's an expression of culture, because historically, Egyptians wore veils. They believe it's also an expression of their modesty.
You have a great line that my veil is my freedom.
Well, you also quote somebody saying, when I put on a veil, I got my mind back.
No, absolutely. And the reason that I focused in the book on rich women who took the veil is to try to shatter this complete stereotype that exists here in the West, that women only wear veils because they're poor. Or this is a class phenomenon. They can't afford it. I mean, so many people told me, and I had to laugh when I used to come back here from Egypt, well, obviously women only wear veils because they can't afford to go to the hairdresser, right? And I would just laugh because it's such a ridiculous explanation. But many people really believe this. But the women that I met, even some young women who were very rich, very educated, they all went to these sessions with a very radical sheikh to talk about their rights as women, how they could become better Muslims. And this is what's so important in their lives.
I'm going to draw one of your lines and give it back to you. You talk, or maybe you're quoting somebody, about women in the Arab countries, I think that's right, Islamist women. There are some constraints, and this is talking about female circumcision in particular, that women in the Islamic tradition are thought of as incredibly powerful. And one has to put some limits on their power or society comes unstuck. Whereas in the West, and stereotypes come in all flavors,
yes.
Where in the West, they perceive the West as thinking of women as passive and have to be given rights so that they can come out of their passivity. That was striking, that it is women who have the power in that set of cultures, but in Egypt in particular. Did I get that right?
I'm sure that there are a lot of feminists out there who would strongly disagree with me on this point. But what I was trying to explain was the potential of the power among women that is perceived in a country like Egypt in religious terms. And what we're talking about specifically is this whole idea that if women are not circumcised, and even if they're not veiled, they are too provocative. And this temptation allows can provoke some sort of chaos in society. Men will become tempted by the sexuality of
the
women.
Weaker sex.
The weaker the weaker slash stronger sex. Yeah. And that will create chaos in marriages. There will be more extramarital affairs. And so in order to maintain some stability in the family, which of course is central to the lives of Egyptians, women have to take precautions so that they don't create these temptations for men. Now, of course, in the Western mind, this seems completely distorted, a whole distorted reading of how we consider to be the relationship between the genders, between men and women. But and maybe this seems very twisted to most people, but there's actually a whole concept which is called fitna, an Arabic word which means chaos. And it has been described to me in very serious ways by many sheikhs that it is this fitna, this chaos, which must be avoided. And in order to avoid it, women have to be circumcised and wear veils.
You also point, you did make an issue of it. You ask, I think, a father if he would have invested the money in his daughter's education, college education, graduate education, whatever, had he known that she was going to take the veil and stay at home.
Yes.
And he said yes. I think
he was offended that you should ask.
But
yes.
But it goes back to some of the core issues in terms of the cultural differences and the modernizing tendency and what a modern Egypt, a modern Islam would look like as opposed to a modern America, assuming we get there. And the notion, at least partially, is that education is of value intrinsically. And it is doubly important because that woman has the responsibility for raising the children and establishing their culture, which takes it out of a purely economic exercise, as we tend to think of it in this country and in the West, and makes it a cultural phenomenon and a culture of learning, a culture of knowledge, which is to me striking.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that on that point precisely, there is this idea in the West that when a woman puts on her veil, she turns her mind off, and that those two things can't coexist. You can't have a veiled woman who's also intellectually developed. Of course, in Egypt, this is not the case. And I think that the example that you're describing, that I wrote about in the book, relates to the wife of a sheikh who was very influential in Egypt. And I asked him, because his wife was actually a lecturer in the university.
And the sheikh is a religious leader.
And she's married to this man who was very influential in Egypt. When I asked him, well, would you have supported your wife's university education if you knew that she would just live her life staying at home, raising five children? He was very insulted because that revealed my own Western bias. And he said, well, of course not. I mean, and his wife said, of course not. I have a right to university education like everybody else. And just because I'm wear veil and stayed home and raised five children, I've given up my position as a lecturer at Cairo University, these two things are not related. And certainly I want my children to be educated. I want my daughters to be educated. And I want to be developed enough intellectually to guide my children.
You have said in six or seven different ways something about family. Is that the core of Islam? Is that what you're seeing played out in all of these things? Is this all about family?
I think it depends on the strand of Islam you're talking about. In Egypt, family is very important. In Afghanistan, as we learned last week, Mullah Omar, the supreme leader of the Taliban, left his young son in his bunker or house or apartment, we don't know, because he knew a bombing was about to happen. The son and uncle died, and he fled. Now, would you consider that to be family values? Of course not. He allowed his young son to die in a bombing raid, and he fled. I don't think you would find this similar kind of situation in Egypt, unless we're talking about very militant activists who are part of an Islamic movement. But I would say, generally speaking, yes, family in an Islamic community is very, very important.
One of the things I found striking, and you don't make a point of it, the people who have been, these Islamists who have been struggling against the government for a long time in various fashions, sort of take things for granted that someone would stand up in a public meeting and take on Sadat, argue with him, knowing that the security police are all around. But it seems that by virtue of doing this, literally generation after generation, that there is a level of bravery and engagement that is remarkable. It's fairly rare. I mean, a caring and a commitment, but also just the core bravery with respect to the public space, to the community, that is potentially very powerful, but also I would assume potentially fairly dangerous.
The years that I lived in the Middle East, I began to feel like such a coward because I could never put my life at risk for any cause the way I witnessed women doing this, men doing this, young students. I interviewed young students in many Islamic countries who are willing to sacrifice their lives for their political purpose, whatever that might be. I interviewed students in Cairo, for example, who just want to run in student elections. They went to jail. They were tortured. I interviewed dissidents in Iran. One man, for example, he will be in jail for the next 10 years. People there are also tortured. We have no idea in the United States what fighting for a cause is really all about and how people are willing to give up so much for democracy, for an Islamic state, however they define it, and for all the kinds of rights that we take for granted in this country. And just here at Harvard, I'm in a program with journalists from many third world countries, and they, when they describe just their daily life in work, it's amazing. They risk their lives just covering stories. And so our concerns seem quite petty by comparison.
This is Genevieve Abdo. We're with her in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she is a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. Bill Russell and I are pleased to be with her. We hope that you'll be with us when we return.